This is interview number 15 in the Raymond Goetz Oral History Project. And would you please tell me your name?
Michael J. Davis.
And when did you start on the KU Law faculty?
August of 1971.
And who was dean at the time?
Well, Martin Dickinson had just become dean. Larry Blades hired me, but during the period, I was hired in December of 70, and as I say, I arrived in August of 71. By that time, Larry Blades had left, and Martin had become dean.
Thank you. And at some point, did you become the university's general counsel?
I did, in summer of 1974.
And how long were you the general counsel?
6 years.
So that would have taken you through 1980 or so?
Correct. No, I became dean in 80.
Okay. And how long were you dean?
9 years. There was a subsequent year in 05, 06 where I was an interim, but 80 to 89, I was dean.
Great. Do you recall when you first met Ray Goetz?
I met him very briefly at a gathering at Paul Wilson's house. I was so naive. I'd been working in D.C. for a congressman, and we'd gotten him reelected. And so it was the fall of 70, and I was interested in teaching, and I was interested in whether I could go home again. I'm a Kansan. And so I naively simply wrote the dean and said, I'd like to be on your faculty. What do I need to do? The first letter I got back was from George Coggins, who was a very close friend of mine in law school, saying, who in the hell do you think you are to try to become a man? I didn't know he was there. He had just joined the faculty. So I was coming back to Clay Center for Christmas, and had only been married a year and a half or so. So I arranged to stop in Lawrence and have an interview, if you will. I mean, it was just basically overnight and the next morning. That night, Paul Wilson had a little something at his house. Barclay, I remember being there. Of course, Martin was there. Paul, the host, Bill Kelly was there. Ray was there. And the next morning, I talked to a few more people, went over and played basketball at the gym, which I found out was very important because Larry Blades had been on the Dartmouth varsity team that had gone to the NCAA Final Four when he was an undergrad. And your athletic ability was one of his criteria as to whether you'd be hired or not. But I made a few baskets, and the next thing I know, I got a letter offering me a job on the faculty.
And so what was your first impression of Ray?
You can't help but be impressed, right? He was friendly, but you could tell there was a lot of steel there too. I of course didn't get to know him just beyond acquaintanceship until I actually joined the faculty and started hearing all the stories.
So what kind of stories did you hear?
Oh, yeah, the same ones. I read your piece about him, a few years ago. And those stories, the terror he brought to first year students.
Yeah.
He's also, as you know, he was also very gracious and helpful to young faculty, always willing to do what he could to get you from here to there.
Anything in particular that he did for you that you recall?
No, he gave me some encouragement. I mean, he said, like, from what I hear, you're doing a good job and keep it up. I remember a couple of those, but I don't remember. I too remember my first year there, meeting him up there in the office at Old Green, as we call it. The profane call it Lippincott, but it's still Old Green to us. And it was a Friday afternoon. I said, what do you got going? And he said, well, I'm going to Kansas City for dinner because I'm 50 years old. I think it was tomorrow or something. I thought, 50 years old? Good God. I was shocked he was that old because he didn't appear that old. And nobody was that old. Well, Bill Kelly was that old. And, Ray, some of the Paul Wilson was that old, but not Ray. He was kind of one of us.
Huh. Yeah. So that's interesting because he was a full generation older or a little more really than a lot of the faculty. The faculty was so young when you started and really still young when I was in law school starting in 82. Did that difference in age affect his relationship with you and the other younger faculty people? And if so, how?
I don't believe it did. I mean, we did not socialize with the Getzes, but I don't think the other generation did either. I mean, they had their own, they had, of course, a large family, and I don't think they socialized a whole lot, with Lawrence people. So, I mean, the relationship was mostly A, professional, and B, just, a chat in the hall. But I don't think the young people were differentiated from, there weren't very many people his era, right? I mean, they were either older or younger. But I think it was more just their own personal choice as to when and how to. Now that loosened as time went on, but I didn't think I was in his house till I was dean, and that was at least 9 years after I had come.
Huh? Yeah, that's interesting. Were you dean? Well, I think you were. You were dean then when he started phased retirement,
right?
And how did that come about? By that time, he was a very busy arbitrator.
Yes, that was part of it. He didn't want to cheat us, and he didn't want to cheat the people he was arbitrating. So it was a personal choice. It wasn't me tapping him on the shoulder and saying, by the way, you're not here as often as you used to be. It was entirely, and I'm not sure anybody had ever done it before. I was just fresh out of the general counsel's office, and I saw no reason why. I don't think I asked anybody's permission to, he got half his salary and did half his work and probably wrote as much as he had before. But I made that decision. He and I made that decision together, and I just kind of announced it to everybody else.
So some of the other folks that I've interviewed, told me that Ray, when he started, of course, he came in with 16 years of experience at Safer Shaw, and which was unusual. And when he got to KU, he actually kept some of his pension fund clients and continued to do work. And I can't remember who told me this. It may have been Judge Lundstrom or somebody else. At some point, I guess it was Martin Dickinson, when he was dean, went to him and said, "You got too many irons in the fire outside the law school."
Sounds like Martin.
Okay. Do you know anything about that?
I vaguely remember. Martin was, I don't know whether it was a written or unwritten rule that there was sort of a 20% of your week could be spent, doing things that related to you, whether you're working as an attorney or you know, helping a firm or whatever. And I think, I don't remember whether that rule was created by Martin or whether he was enforcing one that was already in. I don't think there was any written rule. I think it was an unwritten rule, you know, that at least 84 days a week you needed to be at the law school. And of course, you only taught 3 days a week. So you could certainly fulfill all of your teaching responsibilities Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, or Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the first few years I was there. So all I know is, yes, that was Martin's decision, and that was Martin's point of view about everybody. It wouldn't have been necessarily just Ray.
Okay. Did Ray's kind of exceptional private practice experience, did that affect his relationship or how his fellow faculty members looked at him as a member of the faculty?
No, not at all. It increased admiration, if anything. And I'm sure it affected Ray's view of the rest of us who hadn't had that much experience, but that's not what you asked me.
Because a number of the students of Ray's have mentioned, you know, the extent of his private practice experience is something that they thought really added to his.
Sure.
Yeah. To his value to the faculty. And I just wondered if the faculty felt the same.
Yes.
Yeah.
If anybody didn't, they never mentioned.
Right. So did Sid Shapiro told me that he didn't seem to know how big a deal Ray Goetz was as an arbitrator. Did people on the faculty know that he was really a highly esteemed arbitrator?
Yes.
Yeah. Was he a baseball fan?
Ray?
Yeah.
Not particularly, I don't think. No, no. No, because I always was, and no, I don't think so. Just another client.
That's great. I love that. Did his work as an arbitrator have any effect on his teaching responsibilities, a negative effect or any kind of effect, I guess?
No, absolutely not. You know, I read the student evaluations for every faculty member every year, and he was always right up near the top.
Okay.
At or near the top. And I did read them.
You did, yeah. I had forgotten we did them, but okay. So Ray was a renowned practitioner of the Socratic method. And were you aware of his reputation in that regard?
Yes.
Did you ever hear from any students about his Socratic method?
Well, nobody came to my office, but again, every year, every student had to fill out an evaluation in writing, and they were anonymous, you know, so there was some griping about how tough he was, but mostly people appreciated what came out of his grilling.
Do you know why? Do you have any idea why he was so good at the Socratic method?
No, but I mean it's a combination of information, and he had it all. Personality, and he had it all. And the ability to drill down, you know, you're looking for X, but you need to get through R, S, T, U, V, and W to prove why X is X. And he was superb at that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wonder if it, in some ways, is just a natural thing. I mean, not everybody taught it that way, that's for sure.
No, it is a natural thing. Yes, in many ways. I've always believed that. And there are some people who are exceptionally smart and exceptionally dedicated and just couldn't do it that way. Just had to lecture or you know, just ask one big question and then let people free fall from there. And you know, it showed up in student appreciation because, again, while a few students complained, particularly first year students, because they were being coddled in other classes, everybody came to, I think, appreciate him for who he was and how he did it.
Did anybody ever come to you and ask to be transferred to a different section of contract?
Not that I remember, probably. There was a steady beat to my, about, you know, I want to be in so-and-so's class and I don't want to be in. I pretty well discouraged that you know, the computer would do the job for all of us or whatever system we had at the time.
Did you ever talk to Ray about the student reactions to his Socratic method?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, what did he say about that?
He was sort of pleased. he thought that meant he was getting their attention,
yeah,
which was the point.
Yeah. So one of really my most valuable possessions these days is I wrote Ray when I realized he wasn't going to arbitrate anymore. I had written him to select him as an arbitrator. He said he wasn't anymore because of his health. And he wrote back and, you know, I told him that I valued his teaching very much. And he wrote back, I was not everybody's cup of tea. Was that the kind of thing that he said to you?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I remember telling Steve Fear this, and it kind of fits in the last two or three things you act. Every spring, and so I started in the summer of 80. So probably not in the spring of 81, but in spring of 82, 83, 84, Ray would come in and tell me he was retiring. And I would say, no, you're not. And of course he had every right in the world, which he knew perfectly well, even better than I, that he had the right. But we would get in this, you know, 10 minute argument about whether he was going to retire or not. And finally he'd say, all right, you know, one more year. And the final time he came in, I said, no, you're not. He said, well, I have a heart problem. I said, that's cheating. True story.
Yeah. So did he retire fully after the fall of 87?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he may have taught as an adjunct once in a while, but he left the faculty, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was he an active member of the faculty in terms of faculty meetings and that kind of thing?
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, I don't know.
They were livelier in those days than they became, you know, there were a lot of young people full of ideas about how we ought to do things. And there were conservatives like, and I don't mean political conservatives. I mean, let's keep things the way they are. Martin would be one of those. But he was more of a mediator than a position taker, frankly. I mean, the biggest fight was over Saturday morning classes. I remember that went on, that raged for a semester. And by God, we won. The little guy, why are we teaching on Saturday morning? Nobody else is teaching on Saturday morning. So, and I think he backed that one, the 5 day week, in effect.
Yeah. He must have worked a lot.
Yeah. And he was in his office, you know, amount, but I think he worked a lot either from home or on the road. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of his writing was not necessarily done up in his office on his, you know, typewriter. I think he probably worked outside the building as much as he worked inside the building, at least if you take the teaching out of the equation.
Mm-hmm. What was he like as a scholar?
He was excellent. I mean, he emphasized it quite naturally the practical aspects of the law and its applications in specific instances, you know, rather than theorizing about, you know, what it might be. So I think, I mean, I was told a lot by a lot of people that his stuff was very helpful to them in their labor practices, and probably more that than the rest of us who had less experience were writing about. I had done some, but I think they were by far more practical to the people who read them than most of the pieces in there.
Yeah.
And he'd been on the Law Review, as I recall, at Chicago, right? When he was a student. Am I right?
Yeah. Yep. That's right. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that was interesting, he wrote, like, he must have been just a person of boundless energy, because he was still practicing at Seyfert, and he wrote 3 Law Review articles, one published in the Iowa Law Review, one in Duke's Law Review, and one in another Law Review that I forget. But he was still practicing as a lawyer, but it must have been in looking ahead.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I did talk to him about that. And he wrote them to establish a basis for seeking an academic position at his age. You know, most of us came there in our late 20s or early 30s, you know, having gotten out of law school at 24 and then done some things. But coming in when he came in, I think he felt he needed to show some gravitas, you know, academic gravitas, to help him get the kind of job he wanted in academia.
Yeah. I mean, his articles that I remember really being of practical help were, he wrote one on secondary boycotts that was published in the KU Law Review. And some of my narrators have described their work on that. And that was a very practical piece, but also scholarly. And then his article on the public employee bargaining law in Kansas,
mm-hmm.
both. Okay, I already asked you that. When he retired, finally, did the law school do anything to acknowledge that?
I'm sure we did. I just don't remember. Yes, and we did it for everybody. Then, of course, we would have done it for him. I don't recall the details.
Okay. So there's a sculpture outside of the current Green Hall, and but when you and Ray were on the faculty, you moved from old Green Hall to the current Green Hall. And I think I'd like to hear about Ray's ideas about a sculpture.
Well, my
art.
My recollection is that the building committee that Martin appointed was himself, Ray, me, and the librarian at the time, Barney Reams, and a student, Chris Hall. And the five of us basically represented the fact, I mean, it would go back to faculty meetings and get it approved and things, but the whole idea of the new building And there was a tremendous battle over whether Jimmy Green would or could be moved. And I don't recall any dissent from the faculty. I don't recall. I'm not saying it didn't happen. The general feeling was Jimmy Green, it was going to be Green Hall. We'd already figured that out. And that Jimmy Green should probably be in front of Green Hall. And there are models of the new building with Jimmy out front. And there were spotlights to project him against that back wall of the courtroom that, you know, just to the left of the front door to the building. And he was going to be at night, that statue was going to be projected against that wall. And then Topeka, I think it led by the Attorney General, decided he wasn't going and that he couldn't go. And so, you know, screw us. That's why there was a big lump of cement out front the building with nothing on it for the first 10 years, maybe eight or 10 years. When did you graduate?
85. I think it got there right after I graduated.
Yeah. So that means for 8 years, we moved in fall of 77, as I recall. 78, President Ford came out, or former President Ford or whatever, and inaugurated the building. But it was, years before anything was on Jimmy's hunk of cement out there.
Yeah. Was Bob Steffen the AG at that time?
It was, who was his successor? I think it was a KU grad, law grad. Remember his name.
I can't remember either. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference.
Then the legislature got involved. I mean, it was a big frickin' deal, and KU Law School, in our view, lost.
Right. Well, I think everybody agrees, or most people agree. What did Ray have some ideas about what kind of art to put in there and how to connect up the old building and the new building?
Yeah, no, it was what I described earlier in our conversation. It was,
but we weren't recording.
Some kind of big beams coming on, bouncing around those three buildings, New Green, Old Green, and Frazier. Obviously, Frazier being the high point in between the other two.
Right. So, like lasers?
Yeah. Yes. And multicolored. It was a terrific idea.
How far did it get?
It was gaining enthusiasm when Chancellor Wesco decided what was going to go down there. Certainly the dean, and I don't think anybody on the faculty had much influence about the selection of that particular sculpture.
Oh, okay. You said that people didn't socialize much with the Getzes, but you were in his house when you were dean. What was that house like? Because I lived right around the corner from it, so I knew where it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was lovely inside. I mean, the art collection was hard to miss. It was pretty kitschy, as you know, But otherwise it was warm. Did you know whose house it had been?
No.
Jack Mitchell, the football coach, was moving out when the Getzes were moving to Lawrence. And so they bought the football coach's house.
That's good.
There's a factoid for you.
Yeah, exactly. what had happened to, where did he get fired, or Mitchell?
I think he got fired. He left town. I mean, I don't remember whether it was for another job or for just hightailing it out of town. I'm sure I knew the story at the time, but.
Did you ever?
Been what? That would have been 76, maybe. I mean, 66, probably.
Yeah, 66.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he apparently, his first year, Ray's first year on the faculty, he was like a visiting professor, I guess, according to stuff I got from the law school anyway.
That makes sense.
The
everybody testing each other out. Right.
Right. Yeah.
A free look for both sides. Yeah.
Makes sense. Did you ever discuss Ray's art with him, his art collection?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, I'm sorry that no one did, because I would really like to have found somebody that did, because I know it was there. Okay. All right. When was the last time
you might try Barclay Clark?
Okay.
He's not in good health, but I haven't gotten a report about him for 3 or 4 months, but he's living in Arizona. He's living in outside of Phoenix, I believe.
Okay.
Or maybe, where's the University of Arizona?
Tucson.
Yeah. Yeah. But he also had an art collection and was, my guess is he'd been mayor and three times, and my guess he'd been to the Getz houses more than and paid more attention to the collection. So I think I have an email address, but I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I have your email address. I'll look and see if I can find it.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks. When was the last time you saw Ray? Do you recall?
No.
What did you, how did you feel when you heard he had died?
Terrible. I mean, I don't think I had seen him for two or three years. And so it was quite a shock. I mean, I didn't know that I knew he'd had these problems going back to when I was dean, but I didn't know it had gotten that bad, or I would have made a point to go see him. I'm kind of disappointed in myself, I guess, would be part of it. But I felt like I'd lost a friend, and the law school had lost one of its greats.
Right. Any other memories of Ray that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to share?
I saw him at his loosest. 1974, three people joined the faculty in 1971, Mike Davis and Mal and Louise Wheeler, who were married. And so we were the class of 71. Well, the Wheelers decided in 74 to move back to LA where they'd come from. And so we had a going away party for Mal and Louise. And they made up the guest list. And I was in charge of what was going to happen. So I rented a school bus. I got a third year law student who I trusted to be the driver. And off we went to Kansas City with our spouses on a Friday night. There was a bar, and then there was a bar, and then there was a restaurant, and then there was the levee. And we headed home about midnight, and on the way home, Ray Getz sang his high school fight song for us. One of many highlights of that evening, but near the top for most people.
Did he regale you with stories of Barbara Hale being his classmate?
No, I don't believe so.
Yeah, so Della Street was his high school classmate.
Wow.
Okay. Anything else you can think of that I haven't asked you about?
No. No, they were great people. I mean, yeah, you loved Mo as much as you loved Ray. And I think she had a hard time. after he left. I would see her in a bar by herself once in a while in Lawrence, and I'd always go, you know, join her. But I think she struggled. And of course, you know, they'd lost a child, you know, so it was a pretty tough decade there for a while, I think. But okay. She was a great lady.
Yeah, I mean, incredible power academic couple.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that was the first thing that Steve called me about. He said, what was his wife's name? I said, Mo. So, yeah. Anyway.
Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.
All right.